I want to welcome you to the 15th and the final lesson in this verse-by-verse series through the book of Zechariah, brought to you by Mission 119 Ministries. This series is titled Looking Forward, Living Now. More detailed notes are available in the book Looking Forward, Living Now, available on Amazon. Our text today is Zechariah 14, the very last chapter in that wonderful book, and the title of the lesson is Victory. And I would just encourage you, if you have not followed along in the previous lessons, you may want to download those. And certainly, if you're starting here, read the whole book of Zechariah several times. This chapter is the wonderful climax to this book, but it pulls together all the loose ends from the earlier chapters. And so I just encourage you to go look at those chapters for context. D-Day, the beginning of the end of World War II in Europe, a war that raged from 1939 to 1945. The famous Battle of Normandy began on D-Day, June 6, 1944, as approximately 156,000 American, British, and Canadian soldiers landed on the beaches along the coast of the region of Normandy in France. The Allied forces came by ship and landed on the beaches in the largest amphibious military battle in history. The battle continued into August 1944 and resulted in the liberation of Western Europe from Germany's control. The battle liberated northern France, and by the following spring, the Allied forces had defeated the Germans. There is another D-Day on the horizon, however. The long war against God that began with the fall that we read about in Genesis chapter 3 will come to a close. The earthly epicenter of this conflict is Israel, the victim of multiple Gentile nations throughout history. In the coming D-Day, the largest international military force in history will lay siege to Israel, but unknown to them, God draws them to the final battle. It is not their D-Day, but Israel's, because their assault puts a fire to the fuse that will inevitably bring their destruction. This international force will achieve initial success, but when it appears they are accomplishing their objectives, there will be a revival in Israel that results in a Jewish remnant calling upon Jesus Christ to deliver them. Jesus will at first provide a way of escape for those fleeing Jerusalem, and then he will destroy the invaders, and every enemy soldier will die. Jesus, the promised Messiah, will deliver a complete victory. The book of Zechariah, with all of its challenges, is ultimately a book of victory for the people of God. This final chapter in this book is the exciting climax that closes with Jesus's worldwide kingdom in place, characterized by peace, prosperity, and holiness. Now, chapters 9 through 11 comprise a single burden that the prophet receives from God, and chapters 12 through 14 comprise the second and the final burden that he receives and he's inspired to write. To summarize what Zechariah says to this point, chapter 9 foretells the coming of the King Messiah, who will fight for and free his people. Chapter 10 presents the conditions during the millennial reign of the King Messiah. Chapter 11 presents the Messiah as God's good shepherd, whom the people will reject and value at 30 pieces of silver, for which they will suffer under the bad shepherd who will devour them. Whereas the rejection of Jesus in chapter 11 looks to the first advent, chapter 12 looks to his second coming and a time of national revival for Israel. Chapter 13 continues describing the revival that is associated with Messiah's return, and it explains the spiritual cleansing that will be poured out on the Jewish nation. But it ends with the prophecy that two-thirds of the inhabitants of Israel will be killed as God refines a Jewish remnant that will pray for deliverance and be delivered in the day of the Lord. Building on chapter 13, verses 8 to 9, in this final chapter of the book, the specific details are given of the plundering of Jerusalem by Gentile invaders, Messiah's return, and his victory over Israel's enemies, the establishment of his kingdom, and a description of worship during the kingdom. So with that, let's turn to the first verse in chapter 14. Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. Now note that this verse builds on chapter 13, verses 8 to 9, where we read, It shall come to pass that in all the land, saith the Lord, Two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but the third part shall be left therein. And I will bring the third part through the fire. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, it is my people, and they shall say, the Lord is my God. So Zechariah writes here in chapter 14, verse 1, behold, the day of the Lord cometh. Although the prophet has previously referenced that day 20 times, this is the only occurrence in the book of the complete phrase, the day of the Lord. As with the shortened expression, that day, this refers not to a 24-hour period of time, but a future time of blessing and judgment upon Israel and the nations. During this future time, the prophet says, thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. The reference to thy is to Israel, as it is in chapter 13, verse 8, where it references all the land, meaning the land of Israel. But it's especially to Jerusalem, and you'll see that in the next verse, chapter 14, verse 2. While the events portrayed are not limited to Jerusalem, that city is the focal point. What this verse confirms is that Gentile invaders find initial success in overtaking Israel, and they even take the holy city and plunder it. This daily invasion, perhaps in connection with other judgments during the tribulation period, reduces the Jewish population in Israel by two-thirds, as described back in chapter 13. We know from other passages that Antichrist will appear on the world scene, and he will rapidly ascend to worldwide domination. He will make peace with Israel with a seven-year treaty, and then defy that treaty in the middle of the 7 years, and then persecute the Jewish people. Meanwhile, some nations will move against him in rebellion, and they will bring their forces to Jerusalem, where Antichrist will be. We get this in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel 9, Daniel 11, Revelation 13, Revelation 16, Revelation 19, are some key passages for this background. They will be in for a rude awakening when they discover that it is not their day, but the Lord's. Verse 2, for I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Continuing his description of the day of the Lord, God says through the prophet, I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished. This gathering of the nations against Jerusalem is usually referred to as the Battle of Armageddon. These nations believe they are coming against Antichrist, when in fact, God is bringing them there to judge them. The book of Revelation confirms that much of the world will be deceived into worshiping the Antichrist, and so there will be apostates even within Israel. But at the same time, as Zechariah prophesies in chapter 12, there will be a time of great revival in Israel before the Lord returns. Passages like Revelation 16, verses 12 to 16, and Joel chapter 3 also address this gathering of the nations for judgment. Jerusalem will be overtaken. The houses will be sacked for plunder. The women will be raped. These are typical descriptions of warfare, both in the ancient world and now, as the media reporting that comes to our televisions confirms. There are no atrocities that mankind is incapable of doing. The terrible deeds that will be done at this time are the reason that Jesus warned the Jewish people to flee the city without even taking time to gather their belongings after the abomination of desolation, referred to in Matthew 24, verses 15 to 22. This would seem to take place in the middle of the tribulation period of time. And Jesus said, you know, when you see these things happening, you need to flee for your lives. Now, continuing the description of Israel's defeat, we read that half the city of Jerusalem shall go forth into captivity or into exile, and the residue or the people that are left over, they're going to survive. They won't be cut off from the city. In other words, about half the city will escape. The other half will not. God's hand is in their escape, and that's outlined in Revelation 12, verses 12 to 17. Now to verse 3, then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. There will be a turning point when the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. Although the Gentiles will be permitted this initial success in taking Israel and taking Jerusalem, their aggression will be brought to a halt as God intervenes to fight the invading armies. This, of course, speaks of Jesus' return, or what we might think of as his second triumphal entry. The first one happened at Mount Olivet at the beginning of the Passion Week in the Gospels. As predicted in Zechariah chapter 9, Jesus entered the city on a donkey, humble and having salvation. His victory then was over sin and death. The second triumphal entry also involves Mount Olivet. But this time, the victory will be over the nations that oppose God and his people. This victory is also detailed in Revelation 19, verses 11 to 21. It is, in fact, Jesus, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, who intervenes for his people as when he fought in the day of battle. Now, probably a better translation of that phrase and one that fits the context is more in the present tense, as when he fights in the day of battle. This is not a reference to a battle in the past, but an emphasis on the Lord's personal participation in this future battle to come. His return will be in response to a great national revival that we studied in Zechariah 12 and 13. Some of the details of this deliverance are recorded in chapter 2, verses 8 and 9, chapter 9, verses 10 to 17, chapter 12, verses 1 to 9. This present chapter, though, it expands on what was said before, and it pulls together and focuses particularly on the role of Messiah. Verse 4, "His feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west. And there shall be a very great valley, and half the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south." The text says that his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. There can be no reasonable interpretation here, but a literal one, as the verse doubles down on the geographic location, adding the phrase, "which is before Jerusalem on the east." There's also no dispute that this is Messiah Jesus Christ. When he ascended from the Mount of Olives, as we read in Acts chapter 1, verse 11, the angel said, "You men of Galilee, why stand you gazing up into heaven? This same Jesus, which is taken up from you into heaven, shall so come in like manner as you have seen him go into heaven." Zechariah 14:4 records for us the events the angels announced in Acts 1, verse 11. Jesus will, in fact, literally stand upon the Mount of Olives. He will split that mountain into two. It will create a very great valley. The prophet explains that the Mount of Olives will cleave in the midst thereof. It's going to literally split open and make a new valley. Half of the mountain goes to the north, half to the south. This may result in a great earthquake. We can expect that. It will form a new valley that will permit the Jewish remnant in Jerusalem to escape the city, and it will also be a place where Jesus will draw the Gentile invaders to destroy them. This should remind us of what happened when God brought the people through the Red Sea and then drew the wicked Egyptians after them. The prophet Joel likely refers to this new valley when he connects the Battle of Armageddon with what is called the Valley of Jehoshaphat. That's the Valley of God Judges, Joel chapter 3, verse 2, and Joel chapter 3, verse 12. This newly formed set of two mountains with a great valley between them is probably the two bronze mountains of the climactic eighth night vision in Zechariah 6, and that's something we covered in detail several lessons ago. So I'll move on to verse 5. "And you shall flee to the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach unto Ezal. Yea, you shall flee, like as you fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and the Lord my God shall come, and all the saints with thee." When this new valley is formed from Mount Olivet, the remnant that's still in the city will flee to the valley of the mountains for safety. That's what the verse says here. And in describing the length or size of this valley, the prophet says the valley of the mountains shall reach unto Azel. The location of Azel is uncertain, but what we do know is the people will flee like as they had fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. That historic earthquake occurred during the reign of King Uzziah. He reigned from 792 to 740 BC, over two centuries before Zechariah's ministry, but apparently this historic event was an event within the collective memory of the nation, and to reference it was to reference event that in some sense was as if it had just happened recently. "When they flee, the Lord my God shall come," the prophet says, "and all the saints with thee." The word saints here, I think, is holy ones and probably refers to the armies of heaven that we read about in Revelation 19, verse 14. These would seem to be both angels as well as resurrected believers. This interpretation is consistent with the active role of God's angels seen in the eighth night vision back in chapter 6. Now, verses 6 and 7, "It shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it shall be one day which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light." When Jesus returns with the armies of heaven, it shall come to pass in that day, the prophet says, that the light shall not be clear nor dark. Instead, it's going to be a day which is known to the Lord, not day nor night. In the Olivet Discourse, when Jesus is describing cosmic events, we read in Matthew 24:29, "Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heaven shall be shaken." Other verses also present a future time of darkness, which may be the result of earthquakes and volcanic activity. For example, Joel 2, verses 30 to 31. But the passage here speaks of both a removal of natural lighting, and yet it shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light. One modern translation, I'm reading from the NET Bible, says, "On that day there shall be no light. The sources of light in the heavens will congeal." Because of the loss of natural lighting, there will not be day or night in the usual sense that we think of it. However, when Jesus returns, light will be restored at evening time. This light may emanate from the Lord Jesus himself, just as there was light in the creation event in Genesis before the natural lights, meaning the stars and the heavens, were created. I think it's likely this is the sign Jesus said would accompany his return. Expositors have struggled with Matthew 24:30, when Jesus said, "And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." When the Lord returns, light breaks away the darkness. As commentator Dwayne Lindsay comments, "The time of Christ's second advent will be accompanied by unparalleled natural phenomena." And I think that's right. Now, verse 8, "It shall come to pass in that day that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea, half of them toward the hinder sea, and in summer and in winter shall it be." When Jesus returns, again in that day, the shorthand reference to the day of the Lord, living water shall go out from Jerusalem. We notice in chapter 13 that we've covered in the prior lesson that the Lord opens a spiritual fountain to his people to cleanse the land. Now a physical fountain is opened. Essentially two rivers form. One flows toward the former or eastern sea, the other toward the hinder or western sea. It would seem that the eastern sea would be a reference to the Dead Sea. The Mediterranean is the western sea, and there's rivers flowing between them now. The phrase, "in summer and winter it shall be," means that these newly formed rivers flow year-round. The living waters are not sourced in melting snow from mountaintops, as many rivers in that part of the world would be, but they emanate from the Lord himself. It stands to reason that the current topography of the nation of Israel, which is very mountainous, would not normally permit rivers to flow through it in this fashion. But we will see in verse 10, just a little later in this chapter, that Jesus will also alter the topography, resulting in a new fertile land that flows with milk and honey, the promise of Exodus 3, verse 8. The Dead Sea, as it were, will no longer be dead, but living with vegetation and other animal life. Verse 9, "The Lord shall be king over all the earth, and in that day there shall be one Lord, and his name one." Jesus will be, as we read in Revelation 6, 19, verse 16, Jesus will be the King of kings and Lord of lords. He will not simply be King of Jerusalem or King of Israel, but King over all the earth. He will become the king by routing Israel's enemies, which are all of the other kings in the world that oppose him. When Jesus presents himself as king, who will be the king over all the earth. This is a very intentional phrase. We've seen it twice previously in chapter 4, verse 14, and chapter 6, verse 5, both in the night visions. And he is referenced as the Lord of the whole earth. This fulfills the dominion promise of Zechariah chapter 9, verse 10, where we read that Messiah shall speak peace unto the heathen, and his dominion shall be from sea even to sea, and from the river even to the ends of the earth. It also fulfills Jesus' prayer and the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 6, verses 9 to 10, what we would think of as part of the model prayer. Jesus prayed, "Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, in earth as it is in heaven." As with all of Jesus' prayers, the answer is yes. And this will, in fact, happen. This is a good prayer for us because we see this unfolding right here in Zechariah 14. The kingdom does come, and God's will is done in earth as it is in heaven. The prophets add that in that day, there should be one Lord and his name one. Now, this refers to Shema, the Shema in Deuteronomy 6:4, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord." In Matthew 12, verse 29, we read in response to a question about the greatest commandment, and Jesus answered him, "The first of all the commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord." We have to recall that in chapter 13 of the book of Zechariah, we have described there the reign of Messiah that occurs at the time that's actually described in this verse, and the land is cleansed of idolatry. That was part of the subject matter of chapter 13. Instead of the people following after many gods, there is in fact just one Lord. That's the emphasis here. Jesus has a dominion over the whole planet, and there's only one Lord. All the false religions are gone. Verse 10, "All the land shall be turned as a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem, and shall be lifted up and inhabited in her place, from Benjamin's gate unto the place of the first gate, unto the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananel unto the king's wine presses." When Jesus returns, he will create two new rivers of living waters and alter the topography of the land into a plain so that the living waters will feed all of it. "The mostly mountainous land shall be turned as a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem." This town of Geba was about 6 miles north of Jerusalem on the northern border. And Rimmon was 35 miles southwest of Jerusalem on the southern border. So this is quite a large area. Now, in addition, Jerusalem shall be lifted up, the prophet says, or elevated, consistent with what we would read in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2, and Micah chapter 4, verses 1 to 5. And he also adds that Jerusalem will be inhabited in her place. So we must recall that the third night vision of the eight night visions, it focused on a future where there's a substantial population in Jerusalem that exceeds the ancient boundary. The city no longer has physical walls because they won't maintain the populace of people. The city will be, as the prophet says here, inhabited from Benjamin's gate under the place of the first gate, under the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananel under the king's wine press. These are landmarks that emphasize Jerusalem's specific inclusion within this future blessing. The first gate, Benjamin's gate, is something we see referenced in Jeremiah 38:13 and 38:7. The tower of Hananel, that's mentioned in Nehemiah chapter 3, verse 1. These were in the northeastern quadrant of the city. The corner gate was on Jerusalem's west wall, close to the corner formed with the north wall, and the king's wine presses were over on the south side of the city. Now, verse 11, "Men shall dwell in it, and there shall be no more utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited." People will dwell safely in Jerusalem, consistent with earlier statements in this book, chapter 2, verse 5, for example. Chapter 8, verses 4 to 5, chapter 9, verse 8. This has been a constant theme, a future time when Jerusalem is safe from all its enemies. From this point forward, the prophet says, "There shall be no more utter destruction of the holy city, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited." This allows for the utopian-like environment that we saw referenced in chapter 8, verses 3 to 5, where the prophet wrote that Jerusalem will be called a city of truth. There'll be old men and old women in the streets, every man with his staff in his hand. He's old, full of boys and girls playing happily in the streets. All of that, that's what's coming to pass. We have to recognize that while there were times of relative peace and prosperity in the history of Jerusalem, what is described here is not fleeting. It is sustained throughout the reign of the king, what we would call the millennium. Verse 12, "This shall be the plague wherewith the Lord will smite all the people that have fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh shall consume away while they stand upon their feet, and their eyes shall consume away in their holes, and their tongue shall consume away in their mouth. This is a profound and a scary verse. It reverts back to the subject matter of verse 3 in this chapter. In the Battle of Armageddon, Jesus destroys his enemies. According to Revelation 19, Jesus has a sword that proceeds out of his mouth. I've always taken that to mean that Jesus will merely speak their death and it will happen. He will not have to literally swing a sword at them. The idea, of course, is his sovereignty and power. He can speak the words and it will happen. He will send a plague, the prophet says here. And this plague is what we would think of as a flesh-eating plague. It will smite all the people that have opposed Jerusalem. And by the way, by implication, it will not smite the people who aren't opposing Israel. So we read in chapter 2, verse 8, part of the third night vision, God said, "He that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye." During the tribulation, an international military force will test God on this verse in chapter 2, verse 8. And it will have catastrophic consequences. The prophet explains in graphic terms that their flesh will consume away, and it will happen very rapidly. They'll be standing on their feet, their eyes will be consumed, and their tongue will consume in their mouth, and this will happen so fast that they'll be dead basically before they hit the ground. Verse 13, "It shall come to pass in that day that a great tumult from the Lord shall be among them, and they shall lay hold every one on the hand of his neighbor, and his hand shall rise up against the hand of his neighbor." Continuing to explain Jesus' defeat of the armies that have invaded Jerusalem, the prophet writes that it shall come to pass in that day that a great tumult, that is a great confusion, will come upon these enemies that God will cause to come upon them. Verse 12 describes this plague that kills enemy troops. This tumult presumably precedes the final plague. Jesus confuses the enemy so that they will lay a hold of each other and actually become, you know, start killing one another. In this imposed confusion, the enemy troops will turn upon and kill each other, reminiscent of the battle fought by Gideon's army back in Judges chapter 7. This also fulfills Haggai chapter 2, verse 22, where God says he will overthrow the throne of kingdoms and destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heathen. He'll overthrow the chariots and those that ride them and the horses and the riders. And he says, "and every one by the sword of his brother." So Haggai saw this battle as well. It bears repeating that these arrogant armies picked the wrong time to touch the apple, the pupil of God's eyes, the nation of Israel. Verse 14, "Judah also shall fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the heathen round about shall be gathered together, gold, silver, and apparel in great abundance." What an irony. They've come to pillage Israel, and they are the ones that will be pillaged. This passage parallels Haggai 2, verse 7, where God said, "I will shake the nations, and the desire of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts." Judah obtains a complete reversal of fortune. Instead of being plundered and defeated, which is what we saw in the opening two verses in this chapter, everything's turned around. Now Judah is the victor that gets the spoils from the Gentile nations. The prophet says Judah also shall fight at Jerusalem. The sequence of events is that a Gentile invasion meets with initial success. We see that in verses 1 to 2. But a remnant seeks the Lord, and he returns to the Mount of Olives with the armies of heaven, and he creates this great valley that allows the remnant to escape. That's verses 4 and 5. Then Jesus confuses the invaders. He empowers the remnant to fight on his side. That's what we're reading in this verse. We've seen that as well in chapter 9, verse 13, and chapter 12, verses 8 and 9. This battle culminates in all of the enemy invaders dying. They're all defeated. As a result, Judah's victory, wealth of the nations round about is gathered together, the gold, the silver, the clothing, all of that in great abundance. It parallels Israel's spoiling of Egypt during the time of the Exodus. At that time, Egypt could have permitted God's people to leave. The first time Moses told Pharaoh to let the people go. Of course, we know the story. Pharaoh refused. His pride was his undoing. So also on the day of the Lord, the armies that assault Israel and Jerusalem make very poor choices, and they will face the consequences. Those who come against God's people will pay with their lives and their money. This spoil may be used to build the millennial temple. Verse 15. And so shall be the plague of the horse, of the mule, of the camel, and of the ass, and of all the beasts that shall be in these tents, as this plague. So in the same way as Jesus has confused the enemy troops, so also shall be the plague on the animals, which is essentially the tools of war, as it were, the critical equipment for these armies in the ancient world. The plague will disable even the animals. And animals still play a role in even modern warfare, but they will be of no use when the plague hits, either to aid in fighting or fleeing. Verse 16, it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, when the fight is over, the prophet writes, it shall come to pass that everyone that's left of the Gentile nations, those are the ones that don't die because they're not against Israel, and it's the ones that didn't come against Jerusalem, and what's going to happen is now they're going to go to Jerusalem not to do battle but to worship. It says they're going to go up every year from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts. Which Gentiles are these, that everyone that's left? And the short answer is Gentile believers, Gentile Christians. That only believers will enter Jesus' kingdom when it's implemented is confirmed in various passages like Matthew 25, verses 32 to 46. This is evident from prior verses in Zechariah as well. In chapter 2, verse 11, we read that many nations shall be joined to the Lord in that day and shall be my people, God said. Similarly, in chapter 8, verse 22, many people and strong nations shall come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem and to pray before the Lord. In the verse at hand, these believing Gentiles shall go up from year to year to worship the Lord of hosts, to worship King Jesus, and keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This is future pilgrimages by believers that live in the kingdom under the rule of Christ, as foretold in Zechariah 8, verse 23, where we read, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all the languages of the nations, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that's a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. So the foregoing comments do not mean there are no non-believers in the kingdom at any time. We know that near the end of the millennium, for example, in Revelation 20, verses 7 to 8, Satan will be loosed out of his prison. He will deceive some people. So it does appear there will be some non-believers at some point in the kingdom. But when the kingdom begins, there will seemingly only be believers that will enter the kingdom. That's what the prophet seems to say here. The seven-day feast called the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths begins on the 15th day of Tishri with a day of holy convocation that's treated as a Sabbath day. Special offerings were required each day, and it's celebrated by the people, building and dwelling in booths or tabernacles to commemorate the 40 years of wilderness wanderings with God's manifested presence from the tabernacle. Back, after the Exodus, when they got out in the wilderness, they had a fellowship and an intimacy with God because of his presence there, and that's what's being remembered. This is a time of rejoicing. It followed the Day of Atonement, what we might call Yom Kippur, which is a time of afflicting the soul. Tabernacles is a time to rejoice, and it symbolized the people of God dwelling in his presence and him providing for them. Passages like Leviticus 23, verses 33 to 36 and 39 to 43, Exodus 23, 14 to 17, Numbers 29, verses 12 to 38, some other passages talk of these feasts. What we see at this future time is a fulfillment of this feast because the people of God, Jews and Gentiles, enjoy the physical presence of God the Son in Jerusalem. Now, having said all this, this verse has prompted quite a bit of debate about how the Feast of Tabernacles is kept at this future time, particularly whether there are animal sacrifices as there was in the Old Testament. If the mechanics of the feast are altered in the kingdom, there's no suggestion of it here in the text. Accordingly, it seems to me there will be animal sacrifices, but if that's the case, we have to ask why. If Jesus Christ died for the sins of the world once and for all, why continue the animal sacrifices? And those who would view these animal sacrifices as being figuratively fulfilled as opposed to literally would make that argument, and it's not unreasonable. This is not a place for dogmatism, but I think the probable answer is that these are done as memorials, just as the Lord's Supper is today. Now, one final critical observation is needed here. The families of the earth harkens back to the language of the Abrahamic covenant that we read about in Genesis 12, verse 3. God promised Abraham that in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Of course, this is fulfilled in Christ, who is our substitutionary atonement for sins. But this blessing is further experienced as believing Gentiles enjoy the kingdom. They will worship the king. There's no question of who the king refers to here, as it does in Zechariah 9:9. It is to Jesus Christ, the second member of the Godhead. God permits this worship, and that affirms the deity of Christ, as does the apposition of the word king to the word Lord of hosts. The worshipers will see Jesus, the Son of God, in Jerusalem. We must recall the words of Jesus to Philip in John's Gospel, chapter 14, verse 9. He told Philip, "He that has seen me has seen the Father." And so everyone will see Jesus at this time. Verses 17 to 19. "It shall be that whoso will not come up from all the families of the earth unto Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, even upon them shall be no rain. And if the family of Egypt go not up and shall come not, that have no rain, there shall be the plague, wherewith the Lord will smite the heathen that come not up to keep the feast of tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all nations that come not up to keep the feast of tabernacles." The book of Revelation affirms that the kingdom Jesus establishes will have an initial 1,000-year period. That's why we refer to it as the millennium. And after which, the material universe will be replaced with a new heavens and a new earth. That's the subject of Revelation 20 and 21. During this millennial reign of Jesus, everyone will be required to make the trip to Jerusalem, no exceptions. And so the prophet says that so it will be that those who won't come up to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, even upon them shall be no rain. Once again, we find affirmation of the deity of Jesus Christ and that the families of the earth are required to worship him when they come to Jerusalem. But what about if a nation refuses, if it just won't come? The text says it will be met with the immediate temporal judgment, a drought. For example, if the families of Egypt, meaning the Egyptians, don't come to worship the king, then they're going to have no rain. Now, if they continue to refuse, there shall be a plague, the prophet says, and wherewith the Lord will smite the Gentiles that don't come up to the Feast of Tabernacles. Zechariah also adds, again using Egypt, I think hypothetically, "This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." Now, it's difficult for us to imagine such a refusal. We know that near the end of the millennial period, however, Satan will be loosed and he will deceive many and he will raise a rebellion against Jesus, which will be met with swift judgment. That's Revelation 20, verses 7 to 10. This is possible because while the kingdom will initially be composed only of believers, they will procreate during the 1,000 years. Remember in chapter 8, verse 5, we read about there being children in the streets. Well, they have to come from somewhere. It is possible that people, and even a nation, will at some point refuse. It won't be for lack of evidence. They just don't want to have Jesus' authority over them. And so we've already seen that Jesus' kingdom will be characterized by righteousness. Rebelliousness will not be tolerated. So we have to bear in mind that no one will refuse to come to Jesus because they just don't believe. Rather, it will be outright rebellion. He is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Any rejection of his authority will have consequences. And we read in the next two verses, 20 and 21, really an explanation of why these consequences would happen. Some may think that these are too severe. Look at 20 and 21. "In that day there shall be upon the bells of the horses holiness unto the Lord, and the pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts, and all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them and sieve therein, and in that day there should be no more the Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts." Simply put, Jesus' kingdom will be characterized by holiness. For the Jewish people, horses were not even clean animals. But in the kingdom, everything is holy. Even the least, the things least associated in a Jewish mindset with holiness, like a horse. So in that day, there should be bells upon the horses with the inscription on the horses, on their, like some leather that's wrapped around them, "Holiness to the Lord. This is the same inscription that is on the mitre or the headpiece worn by the high priest, as in Exodus 28, verse 36 to 38. That's no coincidence. There will be holiness. That which is not expected to be holy is, in fact, just as holy as that which is expected to be most holy. Similarly, the common cooking pots in the Lord's house or temple will be like the special bowls that are used before the altar. Every vessel or every pot in the land will be holy. And the prophet says, yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiest unto the Lord of hosts. And moreover, he says, all they that sacrifice shall come and take the holy vessels and seethe or boil their sacrifices in these holy vessels. As with the keeping of the Feast of Tabernacles, I think this further affirms that there will be at least some animal sacrifices during the Millennial Kingdom. Continuing the theme of holiness, God writes that in that day shall be no more Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. Now, Canaanite does not mean that a particular race of people is being excluded. This is used idiomatically to refer to an unclean person. As Charles Feinberg writes, in time they come to be symbolic, that is, the Canaanites come to be symbolic of all that was deceitful, unclean, and ungodly. For proof, note Hosea 12, verse 8 in the Hebrew. God promised that in that day of holiness, no unclean thing shall defile the house of the Lord. And that's the quote from Feinberg. This is fitting because everything in Israel will be characterized by holiness, fulfilling God's purpose of holiness for his people. To grasp the beauty of Zechariah's climactic final chapter, we have to reflect on Jesus Christ as the centerpiece of Zechariah's ministry. He is the rider on the red horse in chapter 1, protecting the Jewish remnant. He is the builder that measured Jerusalem for future blessings in chapter 2. He is the one that makes us clean and fit for service in chapter 3, the one that empowers us by his Spirit in chapter 4, the one that enforces righteousness and removes wickedness from Israel in chapter 5, who in chapter 6 overtakes Israel's enemies and is crowned as the priest king, the one in chapter 7 that requires true worship from the people of God, who in chapter 8 restores the nation and provides security and prosperity. He's the triumphal king of chapter 9, the provider of kingdom blessings in chapter 10, the good shepherd of chapter 11, the defender of Israel in chapter 12, the fountain for cleansing in chapter 13, and in this final climactic chapter, the victorious reigning priest, king, Messiah of the whole world, whose kingdom exhibits holiness. This vision ends with the Jewish people finally in a state of security and holiness in their promised land, a light to the Gentiles who travel there to worship King Jesus. This fulfills God's promises to Abraham and to David. It should be noted that the passage gives no indication of an end of the kingdom. As Daniel would write in chapter 7 of his book, verses 13 and 14, I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. And again, that's Daniel 7, 13 to 14. Being the people of God necessarily includes a life lived in view, not only of the present time, but the future glory of Jesus' eternal reign on earth. It is a life that looks forward to all these glorious blessings outlined in the book of Zechariah, but a life that lives now in fervent anticipation. Whatever challenges we may face during our mortal time on earth, we know that Jesus will be victorious and we will enjoy the blessings of living in his kingdom as his people. That hope should comfort and encourage us. Holy, how frequently we read that word in the Bible, holy or holiness. In 1 Peter, the apostle exhorts, but as he which is called you is holy, so be ye holy in all manner of conversation. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 15. God says, be ye holy for I am holy. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 16. To be holy is to take on the divine nature. Yet because that is so foreign to who we are in the flesh, we struggle to even define what holiness is. Surely it entails notions of separation from worldliness, being distinct or peculiar or a cut above all that's tied to this decaying world. It is a profound truth that during our Christian lives, this side of eternity, we are called upon to be holy, knowing that we will soon be in the kingdom of Jesus Christ that will be characterized by holiness. If there is something Christians in the United States desperately need, it is to know God better by learning holiness. Living in anticipation of Jesus' kingdom should stir our hearts to seek to be holy in how we think, what we say, every action that we take. In a world system that is antithetical to all that God stands for, personal holiness will make us stand out like a bright light in the blackness of a dark cave. Some people are going to ridicule the light and even try to dim the light or hide it from others, but others will see the light of a life truly changed and different because of Jesus Christ. One thing is certain, if there is no holiness, there will be no light to see. As we keep one foot planted where we are and we press the other foot into the future reality the prophet Zechariah shares with us, our heart should burn for the things of God that we may experience that new reality now and impact others by a life that testifies of God's grace and reflects the holiness to which we're called. I leave you with this application point, the main principle of this climactic chapter of this book. In the day of the Lord, while an international force will find initial success when it invades Israel, Jesus will return, making a way of escape for the believing Jewish remnant still in Jerusalem and destroying the invaders. After this, he will implement his kingdom, which will be holy forever. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the series, and if you haven't had a chance to catch some of the earlier ones, you can download those, pick up the commentary, Looking Forward, Living Now on Amazon for additional background and notes on these materials. May God richly bless you.